Welcome to the Attractions Group Podcast, Episode 5. I'm your host, Ryan Sir. With me is the infamous Don Helbig. Don, how you doing today?
You know, I'm doing great, Ryan. How about you?
I'm doing really well. I had a really nice, exciting, relaxing week. How was your week?
My week was good. The weather was nice. Got to spend some time outside, and I had an opportunity to formally meet someone that's a pretty big name in the attractions industry, Rick Bastrop from R&R Design.
Rick Bastrop, that name sounds familiar. Is there any attraction that anybody that might know you might have ridden that Rick Bastrop was involved with?
Yeah, Phantom Theater at Kings Island, which operated from 1992 to 2002. So he was the brainchild behind that attraction.
Awesome. Yeah, that must have been a real honor to meet him. Phantom Theater is such a legendary attraction that, you know, people seem to really, really love it and still adore it to this day. So I'm glad that, you know, you were able to do that. You know, I got to meet him very briefly, and he definitely fits the role. He's kind of like a, I wouldn't say gothic guy, but he kind of gives like a original Gomez Adams kind of look with like the mustache and the, you know, the suit and stuff. So really, really nice guy. And it was quite an honor to meet him. All right. So Don, let's get right into it. So this is a topic that you're uniquely qualified to kind of discuss. So you've been in the PR business for 30 years, all right? So, you know, in 30 years, you know, it's when it comes down to it, the biggest nightmare and the most difficult part of a job that, you know, a PR person would have is dealing with crisis communications. So the way that it's described, it's a matter of when, not if, something hits the fan and you're responsible for, you know, kind of smoothing it out with the public. So, Don, do you have any, like, initial thoughts about, you know, crisis communications and, like, the role of a PR person within the crisis communications kind of situation?
Yeah, I mean, crisis communication is a very big part of what you're going to do as a communications pro, you know, no matter where you work. You have to be prepared for the unexpected every single day. You know, during my years as a PR person, every day that I was driving into the office, you're always thinking of the different scenarios, different things that can happen. You always have to be thinking and be prepared because you never know when something's going to happen. And if you do it long enough, you know, you're going to run into something that you're going to have to deal with. And then, you know, there's always going to be those other little things as well, too, along the way.
Okay, so one thing that's always been a burning question for me is, you know, if something were to go wrong, like any number of situations could happen, you have at least a few seconds to a few minutes to a few hours to prepare to come up with, you know, some sort of battle plan. What happens when you get a call and you're caught off guard? Like, what would you say are your thoughts on that situation?
Well, that's going to happen more frequently today with social media and, you know, fan sites and things like that, where before, you know, just look at the news media. Back when I broke in, there was the print online, you know, the print edition. It wasn't the online edition. So it wasn't like immediately something that they could post online with the story. So it wasn't going to come out until the next day. So you had time, more time to gather all the facts and make sure everything was accurate before that story ran. Now, you know, if you get caught off guard, like I said, that's going to happen. What you want to do, you want to write down, you know, the name of the reporter, get their number, tell them you're going to call them back shortly. You take a few minutes to prepare for the conversation, make notes, get with your internal stakeholders, find out what happened, and start crafting your response.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds like preparation is key no matter what amount of time that you have, whether it's a few minutes or, you know, a few hours. So how do you qualify a situation? Like, let's say a reporter calls and they say that they had heard on social media that something had happened. What are your next steps for making sure that A, it really happened, and B, that the story that they got is actually in line with reality?
Well, you have to be sure to determine what the topic is, what they're calling about. You know, what do they know? Ask who else the reporter is talking with for the story. Are they talking to, you know, fire departments, police department? Are they talk to anyone else on, you know, that might have been in the park. Just find out who they've been talking to gather as much information as you can. And you also want to ask them what their deadline is, so you can get back with them in a timely fashion.
Yeah, so I guess in that regard, it's not that different from normal PR when you're working with deadlines and stuff. And, you know, it comes down to getting the people exactly what they need to do their stories. Do you have to respond?
Yeah, now something that's changed though, Ryan. Yeah, something that's changed though, Ryan, in, you know, recent years with social media, and that is the reporter's more in a hurry. You know, they want to get the news out there. They want to get it on their social media. They want to get it on their website. And they're able to make updates throughout the day. They couldn't do that before when it was, you know, just going in print the next day. So sometimes things aren't going to be as accurate when it first hits. And then, you know, later on, after you've gathered all the facts and been able to respond back to them, you know, then it's finally going to be the story you want. But sometimes the information, the story's out there that's not quite accurate before you get to that point.
So we've all seen this on the news, you know, when it says like this terrible thing happened at this place. We have not received word from the park, or we have not received immediate word from this store or this zoo or whatever. In your professional opinion, is it, do you have to respond to media inquiries, or is that up to you, or is there a strategy behind that? What are your thoughts with that?
You know, I always believe that you have to respond to the media, you know, inquiries, you know, even if it's to just to, you know, decline your participation, even if it's just to tell them, you know, you'll get back with them. But just let them know that you've received their inquiry.
Yeah, I guess a little goes a long way, especially with integrity and stuff, where you're, you know, we received your inquiry, we'll get back to you, is a lot better than acting like you didn't hear, or, you know, giving the perception that you're choosing to ignore, you know. You know, so yeah, things are happening in a hurry in a crisis situation. So let's say something happens, media is on their way out, social media and fans that you're blowing up. How do you quickly prepare for the situation? Like, you mentioned that, you know, reporters are they're in a race with the average Joe, the average Billy or Mike to get it up on social media. So, how do you prepare when everybody's in a rush for a situation that's probably not favorable to your organization?
Well, Ryan, you have to know what you want to communicate, and you have to know that quickly. You know, you want to develop 3 to 5 brief key messages that you want to weave into the interview or your statement that you're going to give them back, whether it's email or text there with that response. And you want to have that information, you know, those talking points. You want to have that in front of you, nearby, so you can always reference it. You also always want to think like a reporter. You know, ask yourself those tough questions, you know, anticipate what the questions are going to be. If you're going to do an interview, be sure to rehearse that prior to the actual interview, you know, anticipating those questions. And most important, I think, Ryan, is be prepared for that first question. That's usually going to be the hardest one you're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you got to prepare for the first question, because usually that's going to be the hard hitter of what exactly happened. And sometimes you might have to give an explanation for something that's not very favorable. So that's absolutely something to have in mind, you know, as far as putting a media spin or controlling a situation, because, you know, the subject matter here is crisis communication management. You know, so sometimes things happen. It's not a matter of when, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So, you know, when you get into it and something happens that's, you know, a bad PR, you know, you've got to do either damage control or be able to spin, or at least get the proper story out, so, you know, things don't run amok. So here's a 2-part question for you. So part one is, what are some of the do's when it comes to dealing with an interview on camera or providing a statement, maybe by email? So what are some of the things you would suggest?
Well, you have to stick to your messages. You know, look for ways to bridge from the reporter's question to one of your key points from what you want and, you know, what you need to communicate. If you're going to be talking to a reporter, you know, whether it's by phone or, you know, the reporter's on property, you got to watch your tone. You know, maintain a positive tone, but be realistic, be responsive, and also be factual. Use short answers. You know, why use 72 words, you know, when if you were going to do? You want to answer in a complete sentence, but you want to keep it brief. Use analogies to bring your points to life. That's going to help make them more memorable for the reporter, more memorable for the audience. This is very important here, I think, too, is you want to say what you want to say and then stop. You know, again, that's essential. You know, just know when to stop. And if you're asked questions, there's different reporters there and they're all firing off different questions right at you. In that situation, what you want to do is you choose the one that's going to best fit your need at that time, Ryan.
I mean, absolutely. Yeah, you made a good point of answer the question, then stop, because you don't want to say something that you didn't mean to say. You know, in a lot of cases, people kind of trip up once they try to volunteer too much information, I've noticed. So that's absolutely some really good advice. You mentioned that you want to use analogies. Can you elaborate more on that?
We just want to do something that's relatable, you know, to what you're talking to kind of paint a picture.
Okay. So you're basically saying that you want to put it into a situation where you think that the average person can understand what's going on. So if it's something that's like complicated with a ride or a show or some sort of special
event. They can identify with, yeah, exactly. They can identify to what you're talking about.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. So other side of the question, what are some of the don'ts when dealing with the media? You know, with once again, for those of you who are listening, we're talking about for actual inquiries and emails and on camera.
Most important is never lie or mislead a reporter. Your credibility and your park's credibility, it's on the line. You know, when you're talking with the media, so you don't want to mislead them. You don't want to lie to them. You don't want to misrepresent the facts. If you don't know an answer, you know, just say so. You know, never speculate in a crisis situation. You know, anytime you speculate, it's going to go the wrong direction for you. Never use negative language. You know, I think if to be quoted as part of a statement, you know, don't say anything, don't make it. You know, remember, when you're talking with reporters, you know, no matter what your relationship might be with them, nothing's off the record. Anything you say with an earshot of them, or you email them, or you text them, I think that's all fair game. You want to avoid the use of industry jargon. You know, a lot of the audience isn't going to understand a lot of those terms. So, you know, just use layman's terms there when you're talking with the media. Don't volunteer any unnecessary information. I don't think you ever want to do that. And the other thing, too, is, you know, you don't want to say no comment, because that can, you know, be perceived in a variety of ways when you do that. What you want to do is you want to provide like a three-part answer. You know, you say something like, I'm sorry, but I can't answer that. Or, you know, explain why you can't answer that. And then follow up, you know, those two parts, you know, with something like, you know, what I can tell you is, that way you're able to bridge to your key messages.
So, you know, this is actually kind of tracking back to, you know, one of those things with, you know, that you learn in high school, like history class, you know, where there's some debate as to whether I don't know is a proper answer. So if somebody asks you a question in which you don't know the answer, do you give them the answer to a question in which you do know the answer? Or do you give them like some sort of response, like, we don't have that information at this time? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can say, you know, we're still gathering that information. We're in the process of gathering that information. We're in the process of gathering those details for you. You know, but you just never want to say no comment at the end of the day with those, you know, when you're talking to reporters, you always want to have something. But you can always go back to with what I can tell you, and what you can tell them is what you know up to that point.
Yeah, that's some good information. Would you say that no comment is kind of tantamount in today's world to the whole, like, we have not been able to reach them for a response? Do you think that in the eyes of the public that that's pretty much the same thing? Or do you think that the public sees a distinction between the two?
I think they see there's a difference. If you say they could not be reached for comment, I think that's different than saying that when reached for comment, they had no comment.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. So you've been a communications pro since Wilson Phillips topped the Billboard charts. God, what are some of the techniques and skills that you developed from, say, like an off agenda from where it might sound like unproductive, hostile, or irrelevant to an on-agenda item.
Wilson Phillips, Hold On. I remember that song. Yeah, it goes back to 1990 when I started out in my career. But I think, you know, we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, but blocking and bridging would be the two techniques.
Okay, so blocking and bridging. So why don't you give me some of the examples when we're talking about these techniques? Give me some examples.
Well, I think some samples of that technique would be something like, you know, they ask you a question, but you say it's not our policy not to discuss those types of figures specifically, or you say what I can tell you is, or what is important to remember is, and you know, what I'm really here to talk about is, you know, that way you're able to reframe a question. You know, don't be afraid to reframe those questions that you're getting, Ryan. And you know, you only want to block a question, though, if there's a good reason to do it. You know, you maybe reframe the question, or, you know, you say what I can tell you is, or what I'm here to talk about is, but only block a question when there's a really good reason to do it.
Okay, so when, so for example, when a question might be particularly hostile, or if you believe it might be loaded, or if it's a question in which you absolutely cannot answer it, for example, you know, there's some sort of incident in a park and somebody says, well, how many people were in the park today? Like, obviously that's a policy concern from many different standpoints as to why to not answer that question. Would you say that that's a good example?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's reasons not to give attendance figures. There's reasons not to give, you know, how many people might have been in a certain area of the park. You know, and a lot of times you may not, you know, if it's the policy not to give that information, there's also times that, you know, you may not have those details at the time you're being asked it too. So it's always, you know, just always stick to the facts, tell them what you know, what you can tell them now.
Awesome. Awesome. So in the news media, you know, they're going to ask questions you don't want to answer. Would you say that it's acceptable to refuse to answer any questions?
I think the only way, Ryan, it's acceptable, the only acceptable way would be to block without bridging. You know, all these things we've talked about can be applied, you know, whether you're doing it on camera, you're replying by email, you're replying by text. But, you know, you have to find a way to answer the question, you know, without necessarily answering the question. You know, give them something what you can tell them about the situation. Just reframe that question so that you can always do that. But just there's just no way to, you know, refuse to answer a question. You just reframe it.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, when you've got, you know, when it comes down to, you know, I'm not going to answer that question, that's certainly not an acceptable, that's not an acceptable answer under almost any condition.
No. You never want to say that in email, text. On air, you never want to say, I'm not going to answer that question. You just want to find a way to reframe it. But, you know, another thing to remember, too, is the communications person, they're the one, you know, whose name is being attached to. We have internal stakeholders that are gathering this information. You're putting all that together, the craft, the statement and that. So there are times, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time to gather all that information. And, you know, the media needs, you know, wants to go now so they can get that story out there. And it's not always there. So you just have to do the best you can to keep providing updates as you learn more about it. And you want to make sure you just don't leave, you know, when you first contact with a reporter, your first conversation, your first exchange by email with a statement or whatever, as you learn more, make sure you're following up and giving them the most updated statements so that story that's appearing online or the next day in print or going on air that night is as accurate and factual as possible.
Yeah, that's some good information. Now, let me ask you this. So in today's world, you've got various different types of media. You know, so in 1990, when you started, you had the Associated Press, and then, you know, like the, you had the newspapers and you had the television and stuff. Nowadays, the role of the PR person has kind of evolved to also, in a lot of instances, include fan sites, as well as, let's say, theme park information sites. And, you know, not to put those down because we use them for sources of information for our pick six very often. So when it comes to people that manage, like, maybe social media, sites involving a your particular park or maybe the industry in general, as well as fan sites and stuff like that. What level of attention would you give them in a crisis situation? Because I feel like the trade-off would be that somebody like a television camera station would reach more people, but it would also be a little bit more one and done, while a fan site wouldn't reach nearly as many people. But at the same time, that's when people discuss it and, information and imagination start to run wild. So what are your thoughts on that as far as the amount of attention you would spend with fan-based news rather than professional news?
Well, it's exactly like you just said. Imaginations run wild a lot of times on the fan sites, and these enthusiast groups that have their own social media channels. So yeah, you do want to include them in the process because a lot of your audience is following those channels. So I think sometimes you to keep it from spiraling out of control, and then the perception becomes reality a lot of times. So you want to make sure that they're in the loop with it, with what's going on, because they're going to have questions. They're going to start talking about it. So you have to keep them in mind. I mean, you're going to first and foremost, you have to deal with the reporters, but you still have to have these other outlets that are out there, all these enthusiast groups. They have to be part of that, at least that secondary level, that you want to make sure that the right message is getting to them as well too, because it can quickly spiral out of control. And then a lot of times that's where the media is, going to report on, because that's what they're hearing. So yeah, you have to keep them in mind, Ryan. I mean, that's a good point to bring that up, because we're talking here about the traditional news media, but there's so many more sources out there nowadays that are delivering your news for you.
I mean, I completely agree with that. And one thing that I noticed as having experience running a fan site is that it's not even so much reaching the few thousand people or the several thousand people that you would reach with your particular story. A lot of it had to do with the fact that the news media, especially then, I don't know if it's true now because I'm kind of out of the game, but they would refer to my website to see if there's any information going on or any news with the park. And that wasn't to disparage, the park itself. It was just rather than, digging through sales messages and stuff like that to find out that there's like an event coming up, they could see like, oh, a lot of people care about this particular topic. And it was just an easier way for them to find it. So when it comes down to like if something terrible were to happen at a particular park and there's a fan site involved, a lot of people are going to have interest with that and discuss it. And I think that that's going to bring it to the forefront. So if anything, it's going to make the story more prominent. So I do agree there is a level of attention that needs to be spent on it. Not replying
Yeah, I
probably
mean,
isn't
you.
a good idea for that.
No, I mean, you look today too, in Orlando, all those Disney, sites that are out there, they're all reporting these kind of, and that's what you're seeing the news outlets, referencing, is these Disney fan sites are reporting this and that, and that's how a lot of that news breaks in terms of what Disney's doing. And so yeah, you have to be, mindful of that, and you have to give them that same consideration to make sure that your key messages, what you need to communicate is being delivered to these fan sites as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. So any final thoughts on crisis communication? Is there anything that we didn't cover that you would give out for advice as far as let's put it this way, if you were going to sum up everything that you said. Obviously there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of individual situations, but if you were going to give somebody one bit of advice before they walked out there and face the cameras for something terrible happening, what would it be?
I think what I would, recommend for anybody that works in a communications position where you're going to have to be the one responding in a crisis is use that time in the morning when you drive to work to be thinking about all the possibilities of things that can happen, and just throughout the day, be thinking about different things as you walk around the park. What if this happened? What if that happened? How are we responding? What do we need to know? And if you're always thinking about those things, you're going to be more prepared than if something just happens and now all of a sudden, you weren't ready for it, you weren't expecting it, you weren't anticipating. Always anticipate. As a communications pro, you've always got to be anticipating that something can happen. It's a 24/7, 365 type role. There is no downtime. You may be not in that day. You may be at home. You may be doing a cookout. and you start getting these calls and things, you always, always have to be prepared. And understand that's a big part of your job. I mean, it's fun to go out and announce a new roller coaster and do those kind of things and do these teaser campaigns and that. But that's really a small part of it. I mean, your big thing is managing the message, you know, that's being communicated out there, whether it's positive or negative. Your job is to communicate those key messages.
Awesome. Well, some great advice and information, Don. I really appreciate you, you know, spending the time to teach some of the younger generations about what happens when things hit the fan. So time to trans.
Yeah, and everybody's going to be different.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I completely agree.
Everything's going to be different, too, no matter where you are. Sometimes, you know, it's also going to be the situation. There are times you want to go on camera. There are times you do want to talk, you know, by phone to reporters. Other times that you just want to provide a statement, you know. So there's a lot of different ways to go about it, too. Mm-hmm. And you really have to use the situation to determine what route you're going to use when.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with that. And your market often kind of dictates that as well. So let's use two different examples. You've got the Orlando Sentinel, where the most important thing in the Orlando area is Disney. Let's not cut that any other way, all right? So they do that, and they cover Disney quite a bit. But at the same time, they've got other things to cover because they're a major city. Right. Would you agree with that statement? Okay. On the flip side, you've got the Sandusky Register. So the most important thing in Sandusky is Cedar Point. So they don't have a lot more going on than that. It's a much smaller city. So they want every little Cedar Point story available. And that's Cedar Point and Cedar Fair and so on. So that's just, you know, that's not a referendum on either one, but I would say that, you know, that's a really good example of how crisis communications could be altered by, you know, the demographics that you're in. And you, I mean, as a PR person, you would have to know the market anyway. So I think that's, you would know that going in, or at least learn that very quickly. But I just wanted to throw up an example of how you said, like, it would be different for everything. That's just one example of how it would be different, let alone the actual situations, too. So,
right. Awesome. But, you know, for me, though, the biggest thing that changed, Ryan, over the years was, you know, when I first broke in, you know, you had time because there wasn't social media, there wasn't the online sites. And, you know, by the midway point of my career, all of a sudden that was changing, that was evolving, and it became instant, you know, that within a couple of minutes of something happening, it's out there. So you just always have to be prepared. You know, just every day something could come up. It could be little, it could be big, but you just always have to be prepared on the crisis side.
Absolutely. And preparation is key to success regardless. All right. So enough about this downer that you wanted to talk about. Let's talk about some good news. So it's time for one of my favorite segments in the show. There's only two segments so far, but we'll add more, I promise. And I'm talking about the Pick Six. All right. Don could not see that intro for those of you watching on YouTube, but I came up with a really cool intro for Pick Six. So if you're watching on YouTube, kudos to you because you're seeing something Don hasn't seen yet, but I'm sure he'll watch it later.
I can imagine it, Ryan, and it was spectacular.
Well, some of the pixels weren't sparkling. Christmas Vacation reference. Okay, so that's right. Story numero uno. We got to find it. Okay, story number one. This is a big one. So, Don, who did not see this coming? Hershey Park announces the closure of the Wildcat roller coaster. So, Wildcat is a Great Coasters International, GCI. It was their first ever wooden coaster, from what I understand. And it's aged, you know, it has some growing pains. And it seems like a lot of the people that who were big fans of it started to kind of wish that there was maybe a Rocky Mountain solution, possibly, which seems to be the rumor. And then that day has finally come, allegedly. The park tweeted out, last ride alert, Wildcat will close Sunday, July 31st. So be sure to visit this month for one final ride. Any suggestions on what to do with this 3,100 feet of wooden track? And then, of course, you know, Rocky Mountain Construction responded saying that they had an idea of what to do. So, Don, what are your thoughts on this? Have you ridden Wildcat?
Yeah, it was when it pretty much first came out. You know, enjoyed the ride. But like every attraction, you know, everything has an expiration date on it. And, you know, all good things must come to an end, you know, as they say. So it's, you know, at the end of the line there, and they have to do something else with it. You know, they wouldn't be doing this unless, you know, it's reached that point to where you do have to make a decision on it. But, you know, it's always sad to see attractions go. And I can tell you that nobody at Hershey Park wants to get, you know, rid of that ride. So it's tough for them too, just as tough as it would be for big fans of the ride. But it's always exciting, you know, to see speculation on what could be coming. And, you know, that's part of the fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree with you there. It's so cool that, you know, obviously with steel coasters inherently due to the laws of physics, you know, they have an expiration date, and you can either do major rehab or you can remove them, as we've seen for so many in the past, you know, 5 or 10 years or so. But with wooden coasters, they can either stay alive forever or they can be completely reborn. And I think that it's so neat that, you know, and we're talking about RMC as if it's a fact. That has not been announced, to be clear, but let's be honest here. That's what's going to happen, you know. It's neat because it seems like that's a very economical solution from what I understand. It's way more inexpensive than putting in a new ride. And then furthermore, it's rides that are very unique and they draw a lot of attention, you know.
Yeah, and here's something else to think about too, Ryan, when rides are retired. Is sometimes it's not always due to, you know, the ride coming to the end of its service life there. Sometimes, you know, when you're looking to put a new attraction in, you're a little bit landlocked, not a lot of space to work with. So what you start looking for then is, you know, guests vote with their feet. So you're looking at ridership numbers, you know, is it still popular, you know, those kind of things. Now, I don't know, you know, I'm not privy to what the ridership is of this ride or anything like that. But there's always a lot of factors that do get involved when it comes time to retire a ride.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes you're landlocked. But I think that a lot of it's evident. When you talk to anybody that's been to Hershey Park, they glow about all the rides. Nobody really says much about Wildcat. So I think essentially what happened was Wildcat had its peak. It's past its prime now. It's time to move on. So hats off to Hershey Park for making what was probably a tough decision, but good luck to them in the future with whatever future endeavors they may have for this ride. So that's pretty good. So, so Don, story number deuce.
Well, Ryan, a new Great Wolf Lodge is coming to Texas. It'll be in Webster, and it'll be the second Great Wolf Lodge in the great state of Texas. You ever been to Texas, Ryan?
You know what? I have never been to Texas in my life. Never been. Have you?
I love it. It's hot. Yeah. Yeah. Multiple times. I mean, it is just like I like it. It's hot. But it's a beautiful state. But anyway, we've digressed here. But it's targeting to open in 2024. According to the Fly social media post, the resort and water park will be at least 400,000 square feet of entertainment, lodging space with at least 75,000 square feet for the water park, plus 10,000 square feet for an indoor convention center facility. And I really think, you know, when you're looking at that part of Texas, you know, it needs something like this.
I agree. Have you stayed at the Great Wolf Lodge? I know that there's one locally to you.
I have stayed in, you know, I think it's now 4 different Great Wolf Lodges. And, you know, I've always enjoyed the experience.
Yeah, for me, it's, I've stayed in 2. I've stayed at the one in Mason, Ohio, and the one in Sandusky, Ohio. The one in, to be fair, the one in Sandusky was lodge number 2. So they built their initial one, I think, in like the Wisconsin Dells area. And then they opened the Mason one not long after. I'm sorry, the Sandusky one not long after. So the Mason one is far more grand and luxurious than the Sandusky one. The Sandusky one's cool, and it has like that camping kind of like feel to it that they try to have. But it doesn't have the luxury. But from what I understand, the new ones that they've opened, like Atlanta, and like I think there's one in like South Florida that they're opening, are just huge, and 400 and 500 rooms, and just, you know, a spa and stuff. So Great Wolf, you know, when they opened that one in Mason, they had some growing pains. Remember, because the it opened in 2007, and then 2008 the economy crashed. So when that happened, they almost lost the lodge to their creditor GE Capital. Then now they've been bought up by Apollo, who in turn created a company with Blackstone that owns Great Wolf Lodge. But since then, you know, it's when you talk about a leverage buyout, often that's bad news, but they've got such aggressive growth plans. You know, it seems like they're opening a lodge every year, and that's $1 billion or more investment. So Great Wolf has their stuff together. It's always a positive experience. And the cool part is it's self-contained, you know, so you can have a Great Wolf Lodge in Nebraska in the middle of nowhere and you can still have fun because you don't really need to leave the lodge.
And highly recommend when you're staying overnight, the omelets that the Great Wolf Lodge do.
Yeah, their food is really good. And it's funny because the one in Mason used to have Pizza Hut Express in the basement near like the water park. And now they have their own in-house pizza, which usually spells for disaster. It's like, okay, they're going cheap. But no, not in this case. Everyone's like, dude, you got to try Great Wolf Pizza, which is kind of a funny thought. But, you know, it's a strange world we're living in. Okay, so Don, do you remember where you parked your car? I don't expect you to have an answer to that.
No.
Well, you're at your house. It's probably in your driveway.
I spent a lot of time circling around trying to find my car.
But when you're at Disney, when there's 87 parking lots and each one has 7 sub parking lots, it may be really difficult to find your car, especially if you're, you're from out of town and you don't know. But it looks like Disney has patented a new feature for their app in which they will use a feature on their app to help you locate your car. So that's really, really cool. So that feature is going to allow you to find your car if you're having an issue with finding it inside the actual parks themselves. So have you ever lost your car like at a park or at some other place or, you know, because I've definitely done that before.
Oh, yeah, for sure on that. You know, I can think of a lot of parks where that's happened, you know, to me. What I try to do is align with an attraction in the park when I get out of my car, you know, that I can see that I'm kind of like straight on with that. That helps a little bit. But no, this looks like, you know, it's going to be a definite useful addition to this app.
Absolutely. You know, at Disney, again, like, you know, we talked about the locker system that they came up with, you know, last time. And, you know, that's a cool thing. Disney likes to do the innovation. I know that other parks have done that whole thing as far as having a feature built into the app where it does help you locate your car. I haven't found one that was particularly useful, but maybe they're the ones to do it. Because when it just shows a satellite view and it shows you where your car is, you can't distinguish that really. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Have you ever been able to use one successfully?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to a degree, you know, not as much as you'd want it to be, but yeah, to a degree.
Awesome. So, you know, when we were talking about the perfect mobile app, that was a good example of another feature that could have gone on there, you know?
Exactly. Well, Ryan, Hershey Park, you know, we talked about them, you know, a few minutes ago, but they're adding haunts to its October lineup. And this is breaking news from Theme Park Insider. You know, we again touched on that a little earlier, too, about how all these different fan sites and things, you know, are involved. And, you know, here's one breaking the news for Hershey Park and that they're adding these haunts. They're going to call it Dark Nights. It'll be a new upcharge add-on to the park's Halloween event, and it's going to allow guests unlimited visits, you know, to 4 new haunted houses. It looks like, Darkstone's Hollow, Valley of Fear. I like Midway of Misery, as well as 4 haunted houses, Twisted Darkness, The Descent, Haunted Coal Mine, and Creative Chaos.
That's really cool. Yeah, I like that idea. The haunt stuff, you know, there's such a big market for that nowadays that it's cool to see other parks kind of either getting into it or expanding it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, become big business for parks is the Halloween event. You know, you used to have your spring, your summer, and then if, you know, maybe you did a winter event, But now, I mean, it is, you know, a big part of your you know, all parks marketing plans is now what they're doing in the fall.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so yeah, two big things for Hershey Park to get it in front of people. So they got the Wildcat, whatever's going to happen with that, as well as their Haunt event. So that's really cool. So again, hats off to Hershey Park for you know, a lot of ruffling a lot of feathers. Let's put it that way. Okay, so now I've got a news story that is a bit of a bummer. Not exactly crisis communication, but it's sad for me. Coming down International Drive, the Tower of Terror billboard is no more. And this is in Orlando. There was a Tower of Terror billboard that was probably 60 or so feet tall that was actually animated, and it had one of the cells or the doom buggies or whatever they call it, the elevators, popping up and down. And I always, that was one of the first things I saw anytime I would go to Disney. So it was a bit of a bummer for me to hear that they were tearing it down, but apparently they're replacing it with landscaping. So I guess, again, all good things must come to an end. So Don, what are your thoughts on that?
I was kind of stunned, you know, when I first heard the news. I mean, that is something that, you know, it's memorable, you know, it's iconic. Anyone that's going to Disney World, I mean, you go by that on your way into the parks. You know, it's a signature type of a thing there on, that drive. And, you know, I was just surprised that, you know, it was going, but, you know, like you said, all good things there, you know, must come to an end at some point. You know, it's part of the memories that I have of going to Disney World, you know, seeing that and, you know, seeing my daughter's eyes light up when she would see that. I want to experience that, you know, those kind of things. And, oh, that was so much fun on the way out of the park. So, you know, those are the takeaways that you have from something like that. I mean, it's just something in the medium of a road. But I mean, it's connected to so many memories that people have, you know, millions of people have of Walt Disney World.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's almost like, you know, it's, you know, there's the castle and there's, you know, different things like that, that you see it and it definitely sparks it. But what's funny is, for Cinderella Castle and the actual Tower of Terror ride and Spaceship Earth and stuff like that, I feel like that, there's a disconnect from it. And part of that is a result of the fact that not only do you see it in the parks, but you see a lot of pictures of it. Something like this, not a lot of people are taking pictures of because you're in your car. So your emotional connection to it is actually arriving at Walt Disney World. So I think that's why it's kind of sad. So, you know,
one of the first things you see, one of the last things, you know, it's got, you know, two touch points there. Or hat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So Don, you are going a little bit crazy on, I don't know why you're resizing, but I'm all zoomed in on you. So I'm going to go ahead and fix this live here for some fun.
I didn't touch anything.
No, it wasn't you. This is society's fault, but okay. I got you fixed. Okay. Okay.
All right. Well,
last story. This one's all you, Don.
Yeah. On our pick six, and it's happening, you know, reportedly, as we do this podcast here, but Wonder Woman Flight of Courage at Six Flags Magic Mountain finally has its opening date.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, we kind of talked about that. Is it what's right now? So it's July 16th or is it the 17th? I think it's the 17th. So it's tomorrow. No, it's July 16th. You're right. It's happening right now. So I saw that, you know, some members of ACE and stuff did some media day things the other day. So, again, I'm glad they got it opened. This is a year-round park. I know I brought this up
before. Yeah, 20th coaster there, too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so this is like the Cedar Point of the West almost when it's, you know, competing for the biggest and the best, you know, roller coasters. But do you think that there are any considerations to have when you know, for the timing of opening a coaster when you're a year-round park like that? Or do you think that they just opened it when it was ready?
I think you open it, you know, I mean, sometimes you want to have a certain time of year that you want to do something like that. And, but when you're year-round, you know, you don't, there's no rush. Mm-hmm. I mean, you open it at the time that's right for you, not at the time necessarily everybody, you know, wants to see it open. So there are those advantages there with that, where if you're a seasonal park, you know, there's a limited time that you have, you know, with your number of operating days. So it's more urgent to have it ready, you know, more at the beginning of a year than middle of the summer that you might find elsewhere, like with a year-round park.
Awesome. Well, kudos to Six Flags Magic Mountain for opening that. I'm sure it's going to be a wonderful coaster. You know, yeah, I'm glad they got done with that before they started attacking that wildcat at Hershey Park, because that's allegedly what's happening. So I kid. So yeah, that was Six, man. This is a shorter episode, so it's a little bit easier to pack in. Don, do you have any final thoughts before we sign off for the week?
You know, just a fun time again talking today about, you know, the crisis communication, what, you know, some of the, you know, young PR professionals out there, you know, what you want to be thinking about, you know, day by day, you know, as you arrive at your park, you know, to begin your work day. I think some of these topics that we had to talk about tonight with the Pick Six were good. Yeah, I think it was, you know, another fun episode with you, Ryan.
Awesome. Always a pleasure, Don. So thank you for taking the time to be on the podcast with me. So we did not plug this at the top of the podcast like we promised ourselves we would, but Twitter, follow us at @attractions_GRP. So that's @attractions_GRP. Look for us on your favorite podcast apps, looking for the Attractions Group Podcast. And most importantly, right now, if you want to subscribe on YouTube, as soon as we get enough subscribers, and we don't know exactly what that number is going to be, it's in the few hundred, we'll start to go live, especially when there's big park news, and we'll start to discuss it live. So you'd be able to chat in and you know, see what we have to say about different topics. So look for the Attractions Group Podcast on YouTube. So Don?
How many followers are we up to now on Twitter?
Oh, let's see here. This is going to be embarrassing.
Now, a couple weeks ago, we were at 1, which was me.
No, we're definitely better than 1. Let me pull it up. I've got my phone out right now for you audio listeners. Let's see here. I have Twitter buried because I don't really use Twitter personally. I just use it for this. Okay, let's see here. We have 18 followers now.
All right. Well, let's set a goal. By the time we record our next podcast, which will be episode number 6, we want to be over 30 followers.
Okay. So what can we do? What can we do and what can the listeners do to help us achieve that goal? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the easiest thing is what you said, go to the you know, to the Twitter account and, you know, just hit that follow button there. But I think, too, what we want to do with it is, in time, we want to make this more interactive. And it's your opportunity to ask questions that you have. And the best way that you're going to be able to do that is going to be through this Twitter account. So the more followers we have, the more good questions that we're going to get, and the better that this podcast is going to be.
Yeah, the more I agree. One of the things that I'm really looking forward to is when we're to the point where we can start live chatting. I think that the goal that I personally have, and I think you would agree with it, is that I definitely want to do a live broadcast during the Golden Ticket Awards. I think that would be really fun to react to that live. So we would need enough of you guys following on YouTube in order to make that not embarrassing. So yeah, help us out. We'd really enjoy doing that.
All right. Well, good stuff, Ryan. Look forward to doing this again next week.
That's right. We'll do it again next week. So again, @attractions_GRP. Find us on your favorite podcast apps. Search for the Attractions Group Podcast. Same with YouTube. Look for the Attractions Group Podcast. I'm Ryan Sir with Don Helbig, and we are signing off for the week. Have a great weekend.